Well, I have an interview today with a woman named Jude Fanton. She runs an organization called Seed Savers Network in Australia, and it's sort of the food side of what we were of what you and I were talking about in the lobby, and you were talking about with your last guest. And that's we make assumptions about food and where it comes from, and for instance, heirloom seeds with. Oh, gosh, I'm spacing out on the name of this seed-producing company. It's mentioned in the interview. But even a lot of the heirloom seeds that are purchased by well-intentioned gardeners trying to increase biodiversity are produced by one company, which was just purchased by Monsanto. So now they actually own everything, pretty much.
I think Monsanto...
The transition is complete.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, so let's, I might as well just get going with this. The, just to give everyone our listeners some background. Oh, did I say we're listening to the politics of food?
I don't think you did. And this is KUCI in Irvine, 88.9 FM, KUCI.org, broadcasting live on the internet and, coming into your brain from your speakers.
Thanks everyone for continued listening. Well, again, to back up a little bit, 75% of genetic diversity of crop plants were lost in the last century alone, 75% since the Green Revolution, and, well, a little further back than there. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, their own lists have, 97% of their own botanical lists have been lost in the 80 years, in the last 80 years, just gone. So now when we think about, you know, we can choose between a Roma tomato and a beefsteak tomato and, you know, maybe something that's green and striped. We think that's pretty exciting, but there used to be just thousands and thousands and thousands. In 1949, there were recorded 8,000 traditional rice varieties being grown in China, and 20 years later, there were only 50. Hmm. So that's thanks again to the Green Revolution, the green destruction. And of the small farmers who, there are so few today, but who continue to traditionally use and preserve these varieties, fewer and fewer survive, of course, in the face of huge multinational corporations that we were just talking about. And this has led to diversity continuing to decrease so much that many of the industry's top breeders are using the same genetic material. So it's so frightening. They're creating a perfect sort of storm of, or for a possible catastrophe. But on in some good news, I interviewed Jude Fanton, and she runs an organization out of her house, basically. And I discovered at the end of this interview that she was actually speaking to me from her laundry room, which explains some of the cacophony of noise that was happening at the beginning.
But beats a bathroom.
Yeah.
Because there, you don't want a cacophony of noise
right.
when you're
you don't want
an interview.
She and her husband, Michelle Fanton, have been running this organization for about 20 years, and it's literally grassroots. I know that word is overused a lot. But they started it out of their house, and they have branched out into a national organization in Australia that serves 3,000 people a year.
You just had several puns in that, you know, I mean, literally grassroots, if you're talking about seeds, and then you said they branched out, which is really, really quite good, so you're on a roll right
now. I know, and I didn't even mean it.
Well, I'm telling you.
Yeah, you should just look out when I'm trying. Are you interested in food at all? You eat, right?
You know, I eat occasionally when I find myself getting faint. My house is strictly vegan. You knew that.
I think I did, yes.
My house is strictly vegan. And when I go out, I dabble in vegetarianism. I mean, I'm strictly vegetarian 100% of the time. I'm mm-hmm. vegan about 70% of the time, though I've just reread some literature, you know, on the dairy industry again and have decided to really try to make that 70% more like 90%.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so I understand the politics of food. And
so
yeah,
what,
I actually had
so
Jeffrey
about,
Smith on my program about a year and a half ago. He's the author of the book Seeds of Deception, looking mm-hmm. at genetically modified foods. And mm-hmm. so on and so forth. And that was quite a good interview. So, yeah, I'm familiar with the, you know, the politics of food. And as I said, hey, most people talk about politics over a good meal anyway. So anyway you slice it.
Yep.
And that's a pun. Because you
know. Puns everywhere. Puns on the loose. Well, what I love interviewing people, obviously, but I love even better when I find out something that I didn't know. You know, you still go into it thinking that you know what's going to happen. And But what I learned from this interview is how much can be accomplished really out of somebody's house. And and when we think about these large institutions that seem so scary, the natural inclination is, well, we need another big institution to fight it. And in the Fantons' case, it's not how it worked. It's more effective just talking to their neighbors and networking that way. So,
great. Well, I look forward to listening.
All right, let's cue her up.
Seed Savers, how did this originate?
20 years ago, we started because at that time in Australia, we were getting patent laws, which you already had in the States,
mm-hmm.
where people could patent plant varieties. And it was just one other nail in the coffin toward the loss of biodiversity. Already, they'd been gobbling up our seed companies here by mm-hmm. international corporations, including the most famous Australian seed company, Yates. So it was already happening, but that was sort of like the last straw that spurred us to start a national network of seed savers to look after biodiversity, particularly of backyard plants and those suited to small market gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
Another really big influence for us was at the time we were really into permaculture, which you may have heard of. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's encouraging basically biodiversity in any system, and Australian made sort of description really mm-hmm. of what happens a lot in third world gardens. So Bill Mollison, the founder of that, encouraged us to start the Seed Savers Network, which is modelled in some ways on the Seed Savers Exchange that's based in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways we've gone a little different in that we work in third world countries, they work in Eastern Europe, and also the States being much larger and their organisation being 10 years older than ours, they conserve varieties very very carefully, whereas our focus has been more on educating people to have a go
mm-hmm.
And to get good at seed saving skills. So I'm not saying that they don't do that, but we haven't been very precious about mm-hmm. any one variety, because in our observation in third world countries, in fact, varieties actually move around a lot. And recently we went to Afghanistan, for instance, where the carrot originates.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the countries where carrots were a wild plant and they were domesticated.
Now, what did they look like when they were... Did they always look like carrots?
Well, funnily enough, they were all orange. No, not orange, they were all yellow and purple.
Really?
They had very few orange ones, and just a few seeds that had been imported, because originally they were a very dark root, dark purple. And when we talked to the farmers there about how they saved their seeds, they weren't all that particularly careful about even separating the yellow ones from the purple ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting to sort of think about the purity of things too.
Hmm.
Because another thing that spurred us on to start Seed Savers 20 years ago was we were saving our own seeds in our own garden, and we found over the years that they were becoming locally adapted. We were in a very wet valley in near the rainforest in this subtropical climate. And so we had problems a lot with mildew on our plants, you know, that things would get fungus and die, disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the years we found as we were saving our own seeds that the seeds were becoming more and more mildew resistant, because of course we would only save those from seeds from plants that had survived
mm-hmm.
the attack. So we came to the realisation that you can actually have locally adapted seeds, which when you start to get larger and larger seed companies, eventually till they're owned from a very large organisation such as Monsanto,
mm-hmm.
then you don't get that luxury of having local adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
So we started to see, you know, this whole sort of concept of small is beautiful
mm-hmm.
in every way that applies to food, doesn't it?
And when in that small local environment, you have all of these numerous factors that confer resistance, whereas in a
genetically manipulated seed, you have a very limited gene or range of genes that have resistance. And if a pest can figure out how to get to those, then you're in trouble.
Well, you've hit on the crucial thing about genetic engineering. It's not the actual technology that's at fault. It's the structure of the ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got very large companies owning genetic engineering because it's an expensive technology, at least at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you've got very large production of any one genetically engineered variety.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you don't have the luxury of local adaptation. So that's the crucial criticism, I think, of genetic engineered seeds, is that they're owned by very large companies, you know, and they're not responsive to every gardener's needs or to any one region's needs, yeah?
So what does this mean for, say, people who don't have gardens, who buy all of their groceries at the grocery store? What difference does it make?
Well, that's a very large subject. Let's go. best for your health is to eat fresh food, right?
Right.
So if you go to the fruits and vegetable section of the supermarket or of the shop, how fresh is it? Has it been on the shelf for a very long time and in cold storage on the way and being stored in large warehouses? If it has, then it's not as good as fresh food.
Mm-hmm.
The best way to get fresh food is to eat local. So now, in order, let's go back to the seed. For either of those options, very local or very long-term storage. If something's been bred for long-term storage, then and for large yield, high yield,
right.
Simultaneous harvest, meaning they all ripen at the same time,
mm-hmm.
so you can harvest the whole field at once, then dig it up and put in the next crop and, you know, harvest everything at once.
Like a machine.
It's sort of like industrial agriculture, yeah?
Yeah.
But if varieties have been bred towards those needs, so... there would also be the fact that it can be jostled about the place in a truck and won't be bruised.
Mm-hmm.
Then you sort of, something has to be sacrificed, and
exactly.
We've noticed over the years it's taste and nutrition. Now,
mm-hmm.
nutrition is not talked about enough in terms of fruits and vegetables varieties, right?
Right.
Because you can talk about freshness. That's one way in which you retain nutrition. You can
mm-hmm.
talk about the way in which things are grown, organic or conventional chemical agriculture. But our argument now is added to that is consider what variety has been used to produce that that produce, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And there's been studies done, not enough studies, but some that indicate very clearly, and it's what we knew all along from comparing what you eat from the supermarket and what we produce in our garden or buy from local markets, is that the variety does make a huge difference. They've done studies on brassicas,
mm-hmm. which are
meaning broccoli and cabbage and so on,
yes.
comparing them being the same freshness, the same method of growing, but different varieties.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that the very old varieties, the traditional varieties of broccoli, have greater levels of these micronutrients that we really need to fight all sorts of diseases, including
mm-hmm.
cancer. And the New Zealand Tree Crops Association did a study which was done by a local university there, but confirmed by Princeton, that on 59 varieties of apples, and they found that there were huge discrepancies between seedling and more traditional apples and the commercial varieties such as Red Delicious,
mm-hmm.
That there was much higher levels of phenolic acids and other antioxidants in the more traditional varieties.
It makes sense to me as well that just the fact of more variety would confer more nutrition because you have such a different range of nutrients. Than just one.
True, that's
provide.
True too. Yeah, red apples and green apples, just to be very coarse,
right.
would have a different range of nutrients as well as different varieties within the red or green section. And also you would get different apples at different times of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So then you'd have more freshness because you'd have longer length of time of apple production.
And ecologically, having a range of plants that mature at different times of the year and also survive in different conditions means that you have much more protection against climate problems, early rains, late rains, droughts, all sorts of things.
Heck yes.
But I think that for most people, as long as the food is there, they don't really think about it. You know, as long as a tomato is there, over time, people lose that sensitivity to flavor.
I think it's really important that we re-educate our children's taste buds, actually. it's getting to the point now where kids don't like the sharp taste of heirloom tomatoes because they just find them, you know, just too strong. Yeah. Back to broccoli, because broccoli is one of those sort of supposed health foods. You know, your naturopath or when you read a book about diet, you might be recommended to eat broccoli. Yet the broccoli that we can buy here, and I'm pretty sure it'll be the same there,
probably,
is very large, but it's extremely tasteless.
Yeah.
Whereas the broccoli in my garden is embarrassingly small, but it's so tasty that really you don't need as much. So my theory is, if you think about it, a reason for obesity would be that we are actually, our bodies are seeking nutrients,
mm-hmm.
and they're just not getting enough, so we're having to eat more of the broccoli, more of everything else, in order to satisfy that need for the nutrients.
Oh, absolutely. So we consume more volume to try and get at that quality.
Exact. Yeah.
Now, what does your broccoli look like? Is it sort of bitter? Is it that smaller?
Slightly bitter, yeah.
I love that stuff. Well, we have a few varieties here that we can get. They're called rapini and broccoli rabe, and they're still commercially bred, but that's probably closer to what you have.
Yeah, and broccolini you have?
Yes, we have that too.
We have another one that looks a bit like curly seaweed. It's very small heads, but There's beautiful small leaves, thin leaves, coming up towards you, dark blue, and they're all long and wavy, and they come up toward you, and they're very tender. You know, you only have to pick them at an early point, and when they're in full flight, you know, when they're fully... So you don't just get the heads, but you also get the leaf part.
Right.
Now, that's something else we're into. We're into eating as many parts of the plant as possible.
I was going to ask you
like,
about that.
You know, yeah. Do you know chocos? They might be called Christophines over there. They're a vine with that grows very fast and takes over like half of our building estate over the western side to protect it from
well,
the sun.
It sounds familiar, but I don't know what we would call it.
And it's, chocho maybe.
Hmm.
Chocho.
Anyway,
it's a plant that's called Secchium edulis, is its botanical name, and it's got a coconut-flavoured root. This was a discovery we made when we were pulling one vine out, and we found this tuber out underneath at the bottom. It was amazing, unexpected. We'd never seen it in any books, but when we start to seek around in our library here, we found that yes, it is known, and it tastes like coconut. It was a stunning discovery.
See, I think when you talk about the academics of seed saving and biodiversity, that this kind of discussion gets lost. The serendipity and joy and beauty in all of these weird things. Let me remind our listeners, this is The Politics of Food. I am Joy Hout, and we're talking to June Fanton. She's the director of Seed Savers in Australia. June, can we go back to, you mentioned how important it is to educate children and teach them instruct them, but actually to educate their taste buds. And you said you have some programs in schools to do that?
Yes, we've had a program in our local school here in Byron Bay, the primary school, where over 6 months we put in a garden with the students and taught them about how to produce their own seeds, because that's our focus, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But the garden that we put in, we put both seed-grown things and perennials, such as perennial leeks and various herbs, mm-hmm. and comfrey around the outside, during the downtimes, during the long summer holidays which are about to start here, the garden, you know, the seeds, the things went to seed and reseeded around the place, and the children picked the seeds from the garden and planted the next season, that March, April this year. And we've been writing a book from that experience. We've been writing a book, Seed to Seed Food Gardens in Schools, because kids love seeds. They just love that whole magic of the fact that something grows out of a tiny thing.
Oh, it's true.
And, you know, and two plants grow out of a coriander seed, because it's actually there's two seeds in a little coriander ball.
Uh-huh.
And you could get three or four out of a silver beet or, I don't know what you call it over there, spinach plant.
Really?
And bean seeds. The kids just love all those colours of beans,
mm-hmm.
and shapes and sizes. Lima beans, we've had about 900 beans come through our seed bank here.
900. Now, where do all of those come from? And how does we haven't actually gotten around to how this your seed saving network works. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Sure. We've had over 7,000 altogether samples of seeds come from around Australia, often as a response to to a radio program such as this,
mm-hmm.
or an article in the paper or magazine, people will send us these. And it might be, you know, an Italian family with their tomatoes or capsicum, mm-hmm. or peppers you call them,
mm-hmm. Right.
or whatever. Or, you know, even Anglo-Saxon people that have been in Australia 200 years, families have been here, will send, so like, for instance, one that came in very early days was the Muffet bean from the Muffet family, and they said that they brought it in the iron bedstead, you know, in the post of the iron bedstead, they brought the seeds in then, the beans, in the 1850s. Into Australia, so we collect these kind of family heirlooms,
mm-hmm.
plus locally adapted varieties, plus ones that are from small seed companies, or even from Yates, the largest seed company mm-hmm. in Australia, that might have been dropped or about look like they might be dropped from the catalogues, yeah? Because that's been happening, because 20% of Yates was taken over by Seminus, and Seminus, I was going to mention before...
They were just purchased by Monsanto, yeah.
Monsanto, yeah. And that's the largest vegetable seed producer in the world. It started in Mexico some 20 years ago. And they've gobbled up these companies in 120 countries.
That's actually very frightening news.
Isn't it?
And it seems to have just gotten...
them.
So you have, in addition to having this company that basically runs agriculture around the world, and now they'll control the seeds itself, the last of the remaining seed stock.
Yeah, that's right. And they will... As they always do, they rationalise as any one seed company in any one country, and although they keep the same name, you know, like Yates here in Australia is still called that. It's the family of Yates that people mm. still assume is running it, but they're not.
Right.
It's been taken over four times in the last 20 years.
Mm.
So they still keep the same front, you know, the facade, apparent way in which they work continues, but they're dropping varieties. And then they just get the varieties sent from all around the world in their huge industrial agriculture type seed farms
uh-huh.
in third world countries. And in the States too, there's a lot of seed produced by Seminus in the States with very large machinery on very large acreage.
Oh, it's true. And a lot of what people buy as an heirloom variety is produced by Seminus.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's frightening.
So it's unfortunate because the gardeners who are fairly aware and they sort of know what they're doing, they're still having a hard time getting good quality seed now.
Yeah. So that's why we started the seed network, to help people learn how to save their own seeds. Strong network of people that are swapping with one another.
So you provide training courses to teach people how to preserve their seed, right?
Yeah. And we also have a newsletter twice a year. The one that comes out in March has seed that we have here in the seed bank
mm-hmm.
that have been sent in to us, and we've germination tested them and repackaged them into little foil envelopes.
So you take the seeds that are contributed to you and then you repackage them and disperse them?
Well, we first of all germination test them to make sure that they're actually viable.
Okay.
And also we just observe the seedling to see that they're actually what they say they are, that
mm-hmm.
you can just usually tell from the seed. And then we put them into... If they pass those tests, then we put them into packets, and they're available to our subscribers through our newsletter. So each year we have about close to 300 varieties available at any one time. We play hot potatoes with our seeds. We don't aim to keep them long term,
mm-hmm.
And so they go back out on the trust that people are learning enough about seed saving that they can look after them, and we can disappear. and the second way in which we do it is that we put them in contact with one another through our August newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
They can more or less advertise, or they list their seeds that they have for exchange or that they're offering to others in our August newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
So, but beyond that, we've also started 66 local seed networks around Australia because we want mm-hmm. to evolve out into strong local networks so that they can be saving locally adapted seeds for all
right.
those reasons we spoke of earlier.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're helping to recreate that local structure that was originally in place, you know, hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, before and seed companies, yeah.
Right.
And you know that, Joy, the seed companies are really only 250 years old. Prior to that, they weren't at all commercialized.
Mm-hmm. So you have to have a hands-off approach. You have to sort of let your little seedlings go off into the world and never see them again, which is very... well, it's counter to any modern business practice.
But
it seems to be that's the only model that could actually preserve biodiversity, because it seems like every time we try to go at this and we try to understand ecology and we still try to impose a structure on it, which is counterintuitive.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's amazing to be in the garden and to learn that, because just when you've fixed your theory about how such and such works, something else happens.
Right.
Now, there's some koalas not far from you, you know, our very cuddly, beautiful koala.
Yes.
Looks like a bear, but it isn't a bear, but anyway.
Right.
In the San Diego Zoo.
Yes, I've seen them.
And they have broken all the rules that we Australians believe about what koalas eat, because they apparently are eating different eucalypts to what they will eat over here.
Hmm.
Now, whether it's, you know, fine air of, call it California, or just a different magnetic effect on them being in a different part of the world or whatever, they were eating a different bunch of eucalypts as size of the ones that they normally eat here.
Hmm.
And I find that here, like even with what time of the year to plant things, possibly with climate change, is it, or just things, you know, just the weather changes every year anyway, we're able to grow a lot more things during winter that we couldn't before.
Hmm.
When you say
before, what do you mean?
Well, 20 years ago when I moved to this area,
I also, I was reading recently that there are something like 1,300 international community, these are very large, sort of, it's an oxymoron, but they're industrial seed banks, gene banks, and they're trying, trying to do the same thing you are, but it's sort of, like we just said, it's sort of counterintuitive because, it's only a small fraction of diversity, and they're hoarding that diversity in one place, and they're not growing those seedlings out, they're keeping them in cold storage.
Yeah. This is another huge topic, because the critical word here is access.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's some very fine people and very fine botanists and fine people with great sentiments in some of those seed banks, and I've met them, and they've got very similar interests to mine, you know, in lots of ways.
Exactly.
But who are they working for, basically? You know, they're paid for by international organisations that were set up by IPGRI, the International Plant Genetic Resources Institute in Rome, which is part of the FAO.
Right.
And
so ultimately,
I think that the seed banks are set up for large-scale corporations to have access to them. Might be that governments and universities also are the ones that mostly use them, but then again, a lot of the programs for breeding in the government agriculture departments and in the university research are towards or paid for by corporate interests.
It doesn't solve the issue of food security. Again, because like you said, it's an access problem.
Yeah, it's just a matter of scale too. The problem with them is that they can only really deal with large people, large entities. They can't deal with a small farmer, because a small farmer, it may take a lot of time for them to understand what he wants and whether she can pay for it or how much she should pay or whatever. You know, it's just a matter of scale. And these very large, you mentioned 1,300, but there's also seven like really major ones for rice, potatoes, corn, wheat, etc.
Right.
That are just huge scale and inaccessible to us ordinary gardeners and farmers.
Now, what sort of, I know in some countries, in fact, in parts of Europe, it's now become illegal to save seed.
A long time ago, actually.
Yeah. Have you faced any hurdles like that? I mean, what sort of government, have you had any government issues in Australia?
Not in Australia. An organisation like ours, but more of a lobby group, did find out an instance where the Western Australian Agriculture Department had